Hello, this is For Art's Sake, a podcast that gives voice to museum people. Here we pull the curtain to hear their untold stories. For Art's Sake.
And for your sake. This week, Elena, we're joined by the two founders of Uncomfortable Oxford, Olivia Durand and Paula Larson. They are two doctoral candidates at Oxford. They've created a tour experience which is not just your bog standard walking tour.
Uncomfortable Oxford is all about confronting the hidden and lesser known. Dare I say it, the uncomfortable history that lies beneath Oxford's culture and heritage. The tours have been a massive success, and we're really looking forward to speaking with the two pioneering women today.
Olivia, Paula, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for inviting us. Hi, I'm Olivia.
Hi, I'm Paula.
So first things first, what is Uncomfortable Oxford? What sets it apart from other tour experiences?
Well, we're two, of course, history majors, and what we really found was when you're in Oxford, you can walk down the street and hear a specific type of history. It was very celebratory, it was very romantic, and it was very much this glorified traditional narrative of Oxford. And Uncomfortable Oxford is trying to problematize that history. So we do it through stories, where we take, you know, the traditional narrative and we turn it a little bit upside down. So, for instance, in the case of the glorious story of Alice in Wonderland, which comes from Oxford, for instance, Lewis Carroll being the author there. The story is that on one golden afternoon, the professor, Charles Dodgson, who's the author of Alice in Wonderland, was out rowing with Alice Little, the daughter of the dean of his college, and she saw white rabbits, and he used to tell her the story of Alice who chases a white rabbit down the hole into Wonderland. And so that's the traditional kind of narrative of this beautiful story. But there's an uncomfortable aspect to that, too, because, of course, the relationship between Alice and Charles Dodgson, the professor, has been called into question because of his own writings and his diary entries as well, which were actually later removed from the pages by his own niece, who said that they offended her senses. And the fact that he had this idealized version of young girls, which he would write about later, that a girl of 12 is my ideal form of beauty, is a quote from later on in his life. So, for instance, yes, that's one of our uncomfortable stories.
And this is an example of one of the stories we tell in our uncomfortable literature tour. But we are historians to start with, so we started what we know best, which is history. And initially, we both felt a little bit frustrated about how we could take research a little bit outside of the academic bubble. And we started the project with very much as a public engagement with research endeavor. And we came up with this itinerary and to try to highlight different aspects of uncomfortable histories in Oxford linked to legacies of imperialism, colonialism, but also wealth inequality, gender and race prejudice, and violence in general. And we didn't really know who would come on this tour. And the first day, we had about 15 people show up. That was quite good. Then 20 people, then 25 people. At the end of the festival, we had over 80 people who came on the tour. And you can imagine that was kind of an interesting thing to navigate the streets of Oxford with such a crowd. And that got us thinking that there's truly an appetite for those kind of stories. People want to not have just celebratory stories of victories and very positive narratives. They also want to know what is underneath, what has been overlooked. And they want to engage with those stories because they're so relevant to how they understand their present.
Fantastic.
So the tours, they proved a big success, as we just heard. On your website, you say that your key audience, the people you are most hoping to engage with through the tours are academics, local Oxfordians, tourists, and institutes. So could you give us a quick rundown of why you're hoping to engage with each of these groups?
We really want to facilitate those discussions among different types of publics, not just students with each other or academics with each other. And at this point, the audiences we have for our tours are, during term time, there's still a majority of students, about 50%. But outside of the Oxford University term, it will be about 30% students or academics, 30% local, and 30% tourists. And it creates a very unique opportunities for those individuals coming on these tours, not knowing each other, to actually have conversations about uncomfortable stories, uncomfortable narratives. And for this, we have developed a specific method.
Yeah, so we do invite discussion on our tours. And that's a really key, important part of what we do. The idea is that as academics, there's this concept that we seem to know everything, that we should just give our knowledge to the world in a very special, like, kind of condescending way. And we don't believe that. We want actually everybody who comes on a tour has their own knowledge as well and has their own perspective that is very valuable and worth listening to. And so we encourage discussion throughout the tour. So we'll ask lots of questions. And what we end up doing in our system is to tell a story. So one of the historical stories we've researched with our own research. And then we ask people how it makes them feel. How can they relate to it? What stories do they have that show something similar in the modern? And how does that work? And then you actually get this really great moment where strangers from various different backgrounds are able to share the perspective of, say, decolonizing in Portugal or Canada and statues or personal stories of oppression or, you know, the research that they also do across in a different university. And so you have this really great moment of mutual learning and mutual respect and mutual discussion, which allows for us to explore all the different possibilities within very controversial subjects.
So obviously that's really different from the common tour experience, which tends to be a tour guide talking and people listening and nodding politely. Do you ever find that people aren't willing to engage? And if so, how do you deal with that response to active participation?
If we have people who don't feel like they want to engage, what our goal is really is to feel the space out. We see who's on as a guide. All of our guides, too, they're trained really well to kind of get a feel for the group. So we always start with the easy questions, like, where are you from? You know, like, what's your name? What's your background? And people kind of get more familiar with each other, which helps with the opening of the space. And then also there's a few techniques as tour guides you can really utilize. So, for instance, if you have one person who's quite loud, who's very, very, very vocal, you can position yourself across the circle from them, so that way they're always including everybody between all discussions between you and that individual, for instance. Or you can look at certain people and say, and I know you're from this country, what's the experience there? And if people don't feel comfortable maybe in the actual group discussion, they don't have to participate in like the vocal group discussion at each stop. But between stops is actually where most of the productive discussion happens, because the 10 minutes of walking from space to space is a really good time for people to reflect on what we've just talked about.
Interesting. The discussions around uncomfortable legacies of inequality and colonial histories are widespread in the academic circle. It's a great platform to engage wider public and wider audiences from outside this privileged academic circle. How are you involving these wider audiences in the debates?
One of our goals is, of course, being a walking tour, is to engage with anybody who can just walk up to that tour. And that is actually why we chose that route itself. I think what's very common in Oxford especially is there's this really big divide between members of the university and the people who just walk the streets. And Oxford gets 9 million tourists a year. And not many of those tourists will actually get to talk to an academic from Oxford, despite the fact they've traveled to Oxford for a reason. And that's academic engagement and that's intellectual stimulation. So what we really want to do to engage diverse audiences is try and reach those audiences. So that means we've advertised through tourist information centers in different ways than academics. But we also will get the academics through Twitter and through Facebook as well. But then we also work with local community groups as well to try and bring in a diverse local community so that they can also feel that space is theirs to talk about and engage with. And they bring some of the most amazing perspectives because they live in the space of Oxford and they have for many, many years.
Yeah, so we're always kind of thinking, how can we reach a wider audience? What are we missing? What are other ways to kind of, you know, reach out to the local communities, to tourists, to school groups, to anyone who'd be interested in participating in those discussions? So we try as much as possible to participate in festivals that will also have a very different network in terms of publicity. And also, I guess, even when we think about the diversity of audiences in the way that we give the tours and the way we try to facilitate conversation, we think that this might be a good way for people to very much make those stories or those information personal, because it's very different to go on a tour or go to a lecture and just listen to someone talking. I mean, myself, I would, after 2 minutes or even a minute, I would just start looking away and
still
being
switching off.
I'll switch off, basically. But the things you remember are the things you've discussed with someone. Mm. You'll say, oh yeah, I remember talking with someone about this or that. And we hope that through this kind of method, it brings as many people as possible in those conversations, because they can very much make them their own.
So in addition to your tours, obviously, which are very, you know, conversational and involved, you also offer a series of free events currently. One of them that I'm sort of really interested in are the public lectures. We'll talk about that in just a second. But first of all, why is it so important to put on free events?
And we found that, of course, Our tours are paid, the lowest in the city, but they still are a paid event, and that creates a barrier to accessibility for individuals who can't afford to do it. Our goal is to engage as many people as possible in these conversations, and that means being accessible to everybody who can't even afford to go on a walking tour. So we put on our free events monthly so that there is another option for those who simply can't afford to do it.
So this goes through participating in festivals. So when we do a tour for a festival, this will be for free. But as you mentioned, we have a public lecture series. So because we're in Oxford, because we're in Britain, the history of the British Empire is very much present in the stories we tell. And you can hear my accent, I'm French. But the history of empire, the history of colonization in many Western countries is not at all part of the secondary school curriculum. So what we've noticed is that on the tours, a lot of people have only a very vague idea about the history of colonization, of expansion, and unless they had the chance to go to university and decided to pick history, they might not have had any further contact with this history. So what we decided to do is to monthly offer a public lecture titled A Very Short Introduction to the British Empire. And we're right now finishing up the first module, so first free lecture module of this academic year on the Age of Exploration. We've done the Atlantic Ocean, the Indian Ocean, and we're going to do next week, on December the 5th, the Pacific Ocean.
We would like to move away from the streets and inside the museums, because you do free tours at the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford. Tell us more about this museum and your relationship with it.
Ashmolean Museum is the archaeology museum of Oxford, and it has, I would say it's the number one visited museum inside the city. It's really big, it's very beautiful, and people go in it for, you know, a history of archaeology, but also just to look at the mummies and the statues of Rome.
So we approached the Ashmolean Museum quite early on, actually, in our project in February, and have been very good at collaborating with us. And since May, we've been running once a month two tours of the museum for their after-hours event on the last Friday of each month. And because it's only once a month, really, what we decided was to do a tour that will interrogate what a museum is, how are museums created as institutions, what sort of narratives do different galleries or exhibitions highlight or hide, and trying to engage the public on discussions about repatriation. This is one of our free events, so it's very, very diverse in terms of audience. We can see that there are so many people who really, really want to engage with questions, and it tends to be it's very different each time, but it's a very fruitful discussion to have.
It also helps you bring in the perspectives of the audience on how a museum can choose to decolonize, how a museum can choose to recognize difficult histories, and how a museum could, you know, change even just labels to do such a thing. So small little changes here and there, because the audience is such a creative force. You know, they have such a great perspective that as you know, when you're stuck in a museum corner, it's hard to see past the display. But for people who are approaching it from the other side, they see exactly what's missing. And their perspectives really help to, you know, give us feedback, which we then pass on to the Ashmolean Museum. And the Ashmolean Museum will listen to that. And they are going to go through some redesigns the next couple of years. And we'll be able to incorporate some of the feedback that's taken in from the audience.
Is there any plan to do a similar collaboration with any other museums?
We would love to do more collaborations with other museums. Currently, we've been in talks with the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford as well. Now, they have a little bit more of a difficult history, of course, with sourcing of items and how they are displayed even. Pitt Rivers, of course, himself being a military man who collected weapons to show how civilizations went from what, quote, he said was savagery to civilization, and the need to display in typology amongst types of items so that you could see the progression of peoples, as he put it. Now, that's a really difficult history, and they're really protective of how it's approached, because they are doing a lot of collaborative approaches with different local international communities. But it hasn't gone so far yet. We have also, though, been approached by Blenheim Palace to possibly do something in the future. And we'd love to expand into other museums, institutions, especially because we were walking tour and at some points it gets cold outside. So.
Would it be possible for you to tell us a little bit about the Pitt Rivers itself? So what is this museum?
The Pitt Rivers Museum was founded by Augustus Lane Fox Pitt Rivers, who was a general who didn't have very much money early on in life, but later came into a big inheritance and was able to, therefore, expand a collection of items, originally through his own travels as a military man through the British Empire, where he collected lots of weapons, and he was really specifically interested in weapons to start with. But then when he retired, he got a big inheritance from, like, a long uncle and was able to purchase a lot of other items. And he had this huge, huge collection of about 30,000, I think, items at the beginning that he wanted to put on display. And so he thought the best place to do that was Oxford, being an academic place, and he really wanted to create an anthropology museum. So he donated his collection to the Oxford University on the condition that they create a museum of anthropology with his name on it, so it's the Pitt Rivers Museum, and that they continue to organize by type so that every artifact could be kept with type. So religious artifacts together, weapons together, you know, I guess like even food cooking implements together. And the idea was that you could see the progression if you put items together, in his mind, from savagery to civilization. And that is the very much the theme it was created with. Now today it's the Anthropology Museum, and if you walk into it, it is like walking into the mindset of an anthropologist in the 1880s. It is a very uncomfortable space, especially if you come from a former colonized country, as I'm from Canada myself. But the fact that it's kind of maintained that means that it has to handle its own legacy and is trying to do that through talking about what it was to be anthropology more so than what it is to study other cultures. But it still has a long way to go.
Okay. And those people who are unfamiliar with the Pitt Rivers and Ashmolean, so Pitt Rivers, is it the second most visited museum in Oxford, or would it be?
Well, I'm not really sure about the numbers. I think it's a little bit weirdly hidden because you have to walk through the Natural History Museum, and there's a little door at the back of the museum through which you enter the Pitt Rivers. But I think it's quite visited. It's just a little bit of an awkward space. I mean, it's an awkward space in terms of how it displays things, but also of where it's located in some ways. But we do walk through the Pitt Rivers. So we talk about the Pitt Rivers Museum on our Oxford and Empire tour, which is specifically about the relationship between Oxford as an institution, the University of Oxford, and the British Empire, and how it's changed over time because of the needs of the British Empire. So we walk through the Natural History Museum talking about natural sciences, then the Pitt Rivers Museum talking about anthropology and the study of humans, and then go on to other departments such as geography, international development, which was formerly the colonial studies department, and so on.
So one of the things we really love about the Uncomfortable Oxford Tours is the fact that you do openly engage in pretty difficult debates that people may not necessarily want to have. One of them being gender equality, which you state quite openly on your website, is something you're trying to break down barriers. Could you give us maybe an example of how gender equality comes up as a theme in your tours?
Yeah, we do talk about women in the university and the way in which women have made a name for themselves and a space for themselves throughout history. Often it's unrecognized how some women had a really big influence or had a space inside the university itself, outside of just being a queen or an idol of St. Mary. And women were washwomen, and they had a specific spot, and they made a big impact. There's one really famous woman who we love to talk about named Mother George.
So a painter coming to visit what I'm calling Van Summan, he was coming from the Netherlands, one day came across Mother George and was fascinated by her features. So he actually made a painting of her. And now you can find in the senior common room of Wadham College a painting of Mother George, a painting of a town woman inside a College of Oxford. At the same time, when we still have today a lot of debate within the university about diversifying the portraits that we see in the colleges, because it's mostly old white men with wigs. But in this case, at Wadham, you do have a portrait of an old woman who is also not linked to the university in terms of degree and was just working for the university. So she's one figure that we're trying to bring. And when we try to bring women or other characters into the stories we tell, we also try to bring more of the town into the narratives, into the space of the center of the city of Oxford, because it is so much taken over by the university. So we really try to diversify what we see in terms of both, in terms of gender, in terms of narratives, but also in terms of how we perceive Oxford as a city.
We also like to engage with what's been forgotten as well. In one case, for instance, is where women and how women were allowed into many of those colleges. So if anybody has managed to see the newest Mamma Mia, the second Mamma Mia, there's a great scene at the very beginning where the three women graduate from New College, which is my own college, in 1979. And women were not allowed to even come in till that year. So there's no way that three women were able to graduate. But it's really interesting how these kind of Hollywood approaches to history just assumed that they were there. Mm-hmm. Of course, 79, why wouldn't women have already been allowed into these colleges? But actually, it was the very first year that later that year that they were even allowed to step foot inside the college. So talking about how we misremember these facts really helps bring about those narratives as well.
Another big thing within your tours is the role of the British Empire.
Something which is often, again, misremembered and misinterpreted.
Yes. By this, anti-imperialism in the history of Oxford. And by this, we mean Oxford the town, Oxford the university, and as well as British history in general. And as we see time and time again, this can be pretty touchy subjects for a lot of people. And many don't like having their rose-tinted view of Britain challenged. And have you found that participants, your audiences, do they ever react negatively to the uncomfortable truths that they may hear?
Absolutely. That's what we expect and we train our guides to be able to handle. I mean, one thing I think in academia is the fear that you'll have to handle the criticism that will come with talking about uncomfortable histories, that recognizing them can be either you didn't do it enough or you didn't do it well, and there's criticism on both sides. And so we specifically are ready to handle that. And we've developed a way to deflate tensions, which is actually quite helpful.
So whenever someone makes a very inflammatory statement, rather than opposing their statement by another argument, we try to question them in the sense that we'll ask them, oh, why do you think so? Would you mind unpacking a little bit? Mm-hmm. Or where does it come from? So we call it amongst ourselves the question method. But basically, it is a very good way to deflate tension, because nothing is worse than opposing an argument with another argument. It just creates an escalation of tensions. Whereas if we question the person, it's up to this person who has made this inflammatory statement to interrogate themselves and try to find why they are thinking this, where it comes from. And depending on the kind of argument, depending on the person, it will vary. But quite often we manage to maintain the conversation. So our goal is to very much have the conversation we want the conversation to keep going. We don't want it to break apart and become an argument. And through questioning inflammatory statements, quite often people tend to go back to a more moderate or more moderate statement, or they try to compromise a little bit more with the rest of the group. And we find this is a good way to kind of bring people together, even though sometimes it's difficult. So.
Yeah, it takes a lot of practice, but you can see when you question someone how they suddenly start questioning themselves. And that's a really important moment for them. So why did I just say that? Because if you ask them, it's on them to justify it.
Yeah.
It's not on us. It really takes as an academic knowing that it's not about my ego. It's not about me proving them wrong. It's about them realizing where they're coming from. And at some point, they will realize they're coming from a place of either misunderstanding, misinformation, bigotry, or just in general, a need to be inflammatory. And the fact that it's a public space, we're having face-to-face conversations, makes a huge difference as well, because this is different from the internet. Suddenly, when you say something quite inflammatory, you're looking people in the eyes while you do it. And they have the opportunity as well in that audience to respond. So we do use our audience, and our audience wants to respond as well. So they do also manage to jump in and say, well, you've just said this, but, you know, here's the other. So that's really important to us, is to maintain productive conversation. And we do it with the creed that we don't think that shame and blame are very productive emotions. They're very reductive emotions. And if you reduce someone to shame and blame, that's not taking anyone to a better future. It's just creating more pain now.
And also we think very carefully about the questions we want to ask, so that we don't want to ask questions where there be a so-called right or wrong answer. It's more about how people feel, what their opinion is. And the goal of the tour is not necessarily to give answers to people who come on the tour. We want to give them some context, but mostly we want to provide them with questions they'll keep asking themselves, that they'll use and apply them to other spaces, other statues, other names that they encounter. So that's very much the goal, to kind of stimulate more questions.
So you've touched on a couple of your sort of more specialized tours, the Uncomfortable Literature Tour, obviously looking at Lewis Carroll, as well as the Oxford and Empire Tour. And you also have one which I think is called Uncomfortable Money. Yeah, is that correct?
Yes, we do.
What's sort of the main aim of the Uncomfortable Money Tour?
So this is one that was suggested to us hundreds and hundreds of times by every person who came on the tour, which is, why don't you talk about where Oxford gets money from? Mm. And so we do that now. We started the business school, Said Business School, and we work our way all the way up to the Blavatnik School of Government and the newest Schwarzman Center for the Humanities. And the idea is to problematize the questions of ethics behind funding. Not blame, shame, just wondering, what are the overall impacts and how do you fund a university?
And how it shapes the institution as it evolves through accepting those donations. So we talk about old former donors in other tours, such as Cecil Rhodes or Cantrington. But in the Uncomfortable Money Tour, we talk about more contemporary donations, especially donations from people who are still alive, and how it might also affect Oxford in its evolution over the years.
It's also a conversation about historical donations, which often were from members of the university. Cecil Rhodes himself attended. Christopher Codrington, a slave owner, also attended at All Souls College in Christchurch. But these other individual donors, Wafik Saeed, Schwartzman, Blavatnik, Sackler, none of them have attended Oxford University. So the huge donations that they've left have made a very different modern impact on the university space for them to accept it. And it does have a statement, which is what we kind of we problematize and discuss all aspects of what that really means.
Beyond university, because there is still a lot of discussion within the museum sector at the moment regarding the institutions, who institutions should and should not take money from. And patrons, for example, they're cancelling memberships over partnerships between, let's say, the National Portrait Gallery and BP. In your opinion, are there ways in which we can confront these uncomfortable links between the art we love and the corporations we don't? Basically, how can we work together to make progress in this regard?
I think the only way to handle that question is to just consistently reevaluate and re-recognize over and over again, always, there is problems, and be ready to change when it needs to happen. There'll be times when you aren't ready to change, when the museum literally needs to have a new gallery space redesigned because of, for instance, it needs to talk about where those artifacts came from and maybe need to pay for that gallery somehow. But they need to recognize that even if they are paying for a good cause, like a redesign of a gallery or opening up more space for people of low income to come into, creating better programs for access, that they're doing it through the acceptance of money in some form. And that's just the reality of trying to keep doing things in the museum or academic world. The money has to come from somewhere. And we have to discuss where it comes from and why it can be problematic, and just be ready to adapt when we need to. And we really need to recognize when we're not willing to do that.
It's very much the reality of museums. If they want to be accessible and be free for anyone to come in, then they do rely very much on donations. But not shying away from those conversations would already be quite a big step forward.
With this podcast, we're trying to inspire the future generation of museum and heritage workers, those who want to create provocative and engaging learning experiences. What practical tips would you give to young people who might be inspired by the work that you do and who might want to get involved?
One thing that often is a barrier to things happening is funding. And we found that, of course, we were first started with a Torch, which is a Center for Humanities in Oxford, grant of about 500 quid, which, you know, got us off the ground. But don't rely on just academic sources of funding is usually good. I mean, if people want to listen and do what your activity is, we've now become a social enterprise, almost not-for-profit, we'll be next year, to try and maintain some sort of consistent income. And that means that we cannot exploit our guides, which means they don't have to work for free, which is great.
So
I know, it's a thing in academia. A lot of people work for free, but we want to treat everyone on our team as if they, and that's really good advice, treat everyone as if their time is worth it. But then just do it as well. There's ways to just start.
And to start, really, the best thing to do is to think practically. So initially, when we met and came up with this project, we were taking part in the summer school, and it was a pitch competition for a project. It was a 5-minute pitch. And we completely failed. We didn't win the pitch. We had the idea already, but I think we were very theoretical about it, about what we wanted to achieve. But then when we decided to apply to the festival and join the program of the festival, it gave us a deadline. And they asked us for a title, they asked us for a starting point, they asked us for how long it's going to last. And basically, knowing when it was going to happen made us work on it. So just giving yourself a deadline, actually committing to something and just trying it and seeing how it works is the best way to get anything started.
Additionally, also two people really helps. One person doing it by themselves is difficult because you think you have that deadline, but then there's other deadlines that you have as well. But having a partner gives you a real world deadline and it really helps get things off the ground.
You mentioned funding as a massive issue. A question we ask every single guest: if magically somehow you had unlimited funding, what kind of experience would you create?
It would be,
I don't know,
so impressive.
I don't start thinking about it because that would be very, I don't know.
Actually, would we? We wouldn't. So this is the conversation we have quite a bit, is do we want to take things into the augmented reality realm?
Ooh.
one thing we really value is the discussion on the streets. And actually, funding doesn't help with that more. Mm-hmm. It'd be great to do them for free and then still be able to pay the guide. That would be perfect, probably. But we don't necessarily need to go all high-tech, augmented reality, or create all that many new technologies for it. And the value of what we do is that you get to talk somebody else about an uncomfortable conversation.
Yeah, it's still, you still not need to go on the streets, you need, still need to facilitate those discussions. And the goal is very much for people who don't know each other, who are from different backgrounds, to engage in those uncomfortable conversations. And I don't think there's any technology that would allow it. On the other hand, we are also very aware that working tours are not necessarily the most accessible format, which is why we try to diversify our activities to have the discussion cafes, the public lectures, and we will, in 2020, would like to start having a podcast, a kind of a 20-minute podcast, discussing some uncomfortable histories with researchers to maybe make it more accessible for people who either wouldn't be able to take part in an hour and a half walking tour, or who are not in Oxford or don't have the time, and for them to still engage with those questions and conversations in a less engaged way, because they wouldn't necessarily be discussing the questions, but at least have been able to access some of our resources.
We would love to expand as well to different cities and different places that also need to handle this. Olivia is very keen on us going to Bordeaux. She's being from France.
Well, you know, it would be, there's a lot of history of the slave trade, and would it be the worst place to spend 6 months to develop a project?
No, there are worse places to go, yeah.
Yes, I think we need to treat ourselves a little bit.
If there was one thing you would like people to go away from this interview talking about, what is it?
I think the most important thing that we really want to impart is that engaging with uncomfortable topics is doable, and it doesn't have to be an argument. If you can question someone who comes at you, if you can really learn how not to put it on yourself as like, I need to prove everybody else in the world wrong, but actually say like, I need to make everybody else justify where they're coming from, and therefore figure out where their own prejudice is built. I think that's the ultimate goal, is to learn that you can have this conversation. It doesn't have to be terrifying. It can be productive.
Yeah. Pretty much admitting that some topics are uncomfortable, but we should still nonetheless talk about it. And it will be uncomfortable, but it's worth having those discussions. And thinking that having those discussions will elicit kind of a feeling of shame is probably not the best way to go about it. It's more about admitting that it might be slightly awkward.
And there are things in the past which we should feel ashamed about, but we can still collaborate together on making a better future.
Both so much for joining us. Before we let you go, is there anything else you'd like to plug?
We have a website where you can find us, uncomfortableoxford.com.
And you can also find us on Facebook, just Uncomfortable Oxford, and on Twitter at @UnOxProject.
Yeah, you can also find both of us on the Oxford History webpage, which you're welcome to contact us through.
Yes, and additionally, if you do come on one of the tours, we would really love for you to leave a review on TripAdvisor, because this is a very good way for us to increase our visibility to non-university publics.
Thank you both so much for joining us and sharing your story with us.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
If you like this week's episode, go ahead and subscribe and join the conversation on our social media. You can follow us on Instagram @ForArtsSake.
And Twitter @Sake_Arts.
You can also find us at our website at www.forartsake.co.uk.
Thank you.